Hello and welcome to Android Developers Backstage. I'm Chet Haas from the Android UI Toolkit team.
I'm Tor Norby from the Android Tools team.
And I'm Phil Burke from the Android Audio team.
Android Audio, which is responsible for what kinds of stuff?
Basically any sounds that come out of the Android device. So everything from telephony to audio streaming for movies or music apps.
Okay, is it the, so it's not the drivers, those come from the manufacturers, but it's the, is it a HAL layer to talk to the drivers as well? It's certainly the API for interacting with the audio system.
Yeah, so it's the framework. So when different apps want to produce audio, they have to be sharing the audio resources. So there's a framework that does mixing, and it'll mix audio from different apps and notifications and also policy stuff, like if you plug in headphones into a phone, it'll switch the audio over to the headphones. All the kind of middleware.
I like when you said policy, I think of that as like a governmental regulation that like there's a law somewhere that says when you plug in headphones, we're going to switch the type of volume.
There are laws.
Yes.
There are laws. Yeah. So the apps don't have to do a lot of explicit setting of, you know, where the audio goes and so on. A lot of it is done automatically based on these policies in a way that we hope the user, that would make sense to the user. So right. If they plug in their headphones, they probably want the audio to come out the headphones. So that's a policy.
Okay. So actually, this is a slight tangent from where we're actually going today. But I was talking to some of the other people on the audio team a few months ago, and there are caps. Have we talked about this on the podcast? They're like, there's caps to the maximum volume we can have, which is sort of governed by governments, right? It's actually a policy decision about basically blowing people's ears off.
Yeah.
And then there are types of audio they listen to, such as podcasts, that are all verbal where the volume is necessarily lower. So this is why sometimes like you have decent volume for music on your device, but then you listen to like a podcast client and everything's really quiet, and it's because it's capped at the max volume that you can possibly achieve. But then there's APIs in the media framework where you can actually boost this. You can say, I want to go to some, you know, maximum based on sampled content from the actual stream.
Can you override those limits then?
That's what I'm saying. You can. There's an API, and it escapes me now, but you can actually say, you know, I want you to look at the content and boost it up to the maximum, basically apply the curve to get it up to the actual physical maximum instead of just, you know, the maximum for all content regardless of what it is.
I just got an app idea. Android Developers Backstage podcast, the app, where we double the volume of this podcast for maximum enjoyment.
You know, we've been looking at how to increase the volume of listeners, yeah. And I think that maybe this is the way to do it.
Volume two listeners.
So actually, if you go into recent versions of Pocket Cast, which I happen to use, there's a setting now where you can say, you know, I forget what it's called, but, you know, volume boost or whatever, and they must be using that API. So it's possible. And I think I would encourage podcast clients or apps that are specifically playing like spoken content instead to actually look into this API, because you're going to get better response by doing that.
Yeah, there's nothing worse than basically boosting your volume to hear that podcast, and then you get like some audio notification that just blows your eardrums out.
I really wanted that email notification. Yeah. Really, really wanted to know that I had to go to that meeting. So all of this was a complete tangent. Actually,
yes.
We were talking to Phil today, not about that. That was just like a message from our sponsor. We're going to talk about MIDI.
Yes, indeed.
So why don't we start at the beginning? So cast us back to, what was it, 1981?
Well, it was around there, yeah. MIDI's had its, like, over 30 years now in the industry. It's one of the older standards in the computer industry.
Which is amazing to me because it's still being used. Like, I think of things like digital technologies that were invented there were probably, like, reinvented and cast away, like, 20 years ago.
Well, this is, like, in the 5 1/4 inch floppy era, and the, like, 300 baud modems were cool.
Yeah. I'm just thinking, like, before that.
All those are gone, but MIDI is surviving, yes.
And is that because the audio is relatively slow? And so therefore, you know, you don't need the super high throughput and low latency because, like, if your ears can't detect it, it's fine. Is that the reason, or why is there not a replacement for MIDI?
Yeah, I mean, MIDI is enough for almost every application, and it's very simple. You can, you know, there's just a few little byte commands. Works over a serial port. It was just very easy to implement. You can run it off little Arduino chips. It's very simple, but it's adequate for almost all the applications that people want to do.
And are there any limits that at the time seemed plenty that now it's kind of like, hey, the product? For example,
people,
I can imagine
never
back then,
play more
you'll
two
never
notes.
Have a sound card with more than 12 channels of audio at the same time. Like, is there anything like that, or is it so generic that we can address today's, you know, pop music with, you know, 50 simultaneous samples and things like that.
Yeah, well, the first synthesizers were basically just one timbre. And if you wanted multiple timbres, you would buy multiple synthesizers and you would stack them up. And you would daisy chain them with MIDI and you'd give each one a channel. So channel one would be some, you know,
the bass
Moog type synth and another, you know, sampler. And you could 16 of these. But to go out and buy 16 synthesizers would be very expensive. So they figured no one's going to have more than that. And so there are 16 channels and it's one nibble in the MIDI byte. And but that's been a real limitation. So then people end up with multiple ports. But there's actually a new standard that's coming out from the MIDI Manufacturers Association that opens it up to like thousands of channels and very high resolution. It works over Ethernet, all kinds of things. So that's it's been worked on for years.
But I'm thinking of the last MIDI instrument that I had. It was a digital keyboard that I just got rid of a few months ago that had, you know, five different banks, each with, you know, 100 sounds in it or whatever, mm-hmm. and I probably played four.
Yeah.
Right. And so I'm wondering, like, if you expose it to even more and more and more, like, who's actually taking advantage of all this stuff?
Well, for the channels, if you're, like, composing for an orchestra, you might have, you know, 50 channels of, you know, the piccolos and the oboes and the cellos and the flutes and the triangle and, you know, for percussion, you may...
Because you're talking about different things, right? Because you're talking about addressing individual instruments?
Yeah, I'm talking about the overall complexity of the stuff that you can do with the MIDI standard itself. Like, it seemed like the things that you could do, even from this 1981 standard, went way beyond what I could take advantage of as a, you know, amateur musician, right? So I just wonder what else you could do with, you know, a standard that opened it up to thousands of channels or, I assume, other
capabilities. It seems like 16 simultaneous instruments doesn't seem like a whole lot. It seems like you could blow through that pretty quickly.
I couldn't play 16 instruments.
No, I mean, but if I assume MIDI is used for like composers who want to be a one man band or one woman band for that matter, right? Where you're doing all the different tracks and you want to play them back. That's when you want. Well, I guess you have to buy two synthesizers if you want 32.
Well, a lot of the synthesizers now you can max out all those channels.
Yeah.
And then if you have software synthesizers, you can sort of address a lot more. But you're right. The composers will use lots and lots of channels. If you think about a big mixing board. And there's, you know, maybe, you know, 64 channels on the mixing board, and they'll fill those if they have an orchestra or if they're doing, you know, big ensembles. And similarly, in software, composers will have, you know, pages of tracks for different instruments. So people do push the limits of what MIDI imposes.
So what you're saying is I'm not trying hard enough.
I mean, if you're writing for a string quartet, You're golden. You know, you don't need more than that. But if you're doing a whole orchestra or some, you know, very complex or some of the theater, you know, systems, people are using MIDI to address smoke machines and lights and you know, all kinds of different devices. Control robots. People are using MIDI for all kinds of things beyond music.
So how are they doing it? I was curious about this because all I cared about was actually playing the keyboard instrument, but. Are people just overriding the opcodes in that and saying, well, I'm going to use this, you know, this indicator for this particular instrument to mean that you're turning up the volume on the smoke machine?
Right. So it's so like a C sharp might be, you know, some explosion or something on stage. So they'll send a note on message.
That's when you don't want to accidentally press the wrong key.
Yeah.
Oh, no. We went through the fireworks. That was supposed to be in the finale.
Okay.
Go ahead. I have sort of a dumb question about MIDI. So I imagine MIDI could be used, you know, by the composer who has a synthesizer that they want to connect and they want to, you know, record. They want to play at a slower pace, this difficult part, right? And they could play back fast, right? But when we have MIDI support in Android, is that for that kind of purpose, for you to be able to use your device to drive your musical device? Or is it for actually playing back songs? And if so, is there some sort of standard for what, like how you get a piano and how it sounds? Or can the thing that you composed on your synthesizer, when played back, from someone else sound totally different?
A lot of questions there. I have answers.
All right.
But so let's not do the Android thing yet.
Yeah.
So we'll get into that.
It was more of a MIDI question though. Like, yeah, I don't understand how MIDI works.
I should probably give like a capsule definition of MIDI.
Yeah, that would have been a much better question, actually.
Okay.
Hey, what's MIDI?
Well, MIDI, funny you should ask. Yeah, it's a musical instrument device interface. So so it allows you to connect different music devices like a keyboard. So you may have five synthesizers, but just one keyboard, and you can then connect the keyboard with a cable to one of the synthesizers. You play the notes, and it sends the information to the synthesizer. So when you press a key, it sends a note on message. You lift up the key, it sends a note off message. If you bend that little wheel on the left side of the keyboard, that's the pitch bend, then you can get and that's another pitch bend message. And then there are control changes. So if you turn different knobs, you can affect the vibrato rate or do panning or volume and things like that. So
can it also express like how hard you press the key?
There's both a pressure on the entire keyboard, and then some keyboards will have a what they call polyphonic aftertouch, which is a pressure per note. So you can have individual notes in a chord with more vibrato, for example. Right.
So some of it is setting state for the overall instrument, right? So if you change the vibrato, that must send the information about, okay, vibrato is now at 78.
Yeah.
Right. When you press the key, that's not, well, I guess it is state if its key is on, but it's sending the information to say, do this thing right now.
Yeah.
Right?
So you're sending events, and they're you may not send any events for a couple minutes, and then suddenly, like, boom, you send note on, pitch bend, you know, controllers all at once. So it's different than audio where you have a steady stream of data. You're just sending these little events, and the data, the rate is generally pretty small. The messages are 2 or 3 bytes. And so it's very easy to take that information and then store it in the computer and then just run it back. So if you go through the computer will capture that, store all that information on a given track, and then you can edit it in the computer. If you play this great thing, except for that one note, you just go in and just digitally edit it, which is much easier than editing the audio itself. And then you play back, the computer sends those messages back over to the synthesizer and recreate the performance.
Is the protocol fast enough that there's no noticeable latency? Or if I press 10 keys at the same time, mm-hmm. will it record timestamps with those and send those with the protocol? Or will it just been sent in order and the protocol is so fast that it knows this was roughly at the same time?
There's no timestamps in the protocol, but the baud rate's like 31,250 or something like that. So you get... you can send about a message every millisecond.
Okay.
And so there may be, you know, 1 or 2 milliseconds delay if you play a chord really fast.
Okay.
But generally it's just fast enough. If it was much slower, people would be sort of complaining about it. But it actually works even for drum pads or MIDI drum pads where you're drumming and you're sending MIDI commands to a drum synthesizer. And that has to be very low latency. And MIDI's capable of doing that.
So latency is even not an issue in the orchestral situation where, like, let's say you had the ability to play, you know, all these instruments at once and they're all playing, you know, many notes at once.
Mm-hmm. And you have 16 synthesizers stacked on top of each other, right? The right. Daisy chaining still isn't a problem?
Yeah, well, if you're doing orchestral stuff, you're probably not doing the old stacking of the synths. It's probably using VST instruments or, you know, software instruments that are running in the computer. And in that case, you sort of blow away the channel limitations. And and you can also sort of schedule the MIDI events ahead of time. And you're not transmitting over the old serial port. Mm-hmm. It's just happening in software.
Okay.
And there are also USB transports for MIDI and Ethernet transports right. and stuff.
I assume latency used to be more of an issue when the standard first came out. Like I thought I heard that latency was actually an issue. But that was many years ago where it's not just then the latency of sending the events, but also the thing on the other end that actually needs to process them. So the computers in the synthesizers at that point couldn't necessarily process things as fast as they could today.
Yeah, people would put little 8-bit microprocessors in these synthesizers. But
And latency has kind of been known to be a problem with Android audio.
It is?
So, well, I don't know if that was MIDI, but like that, it certainly used to be the case, right? With playing back,
different issue, and yeah, they it's something they continue to work on. Difficult right. issues with like you know thread scheduling.
Exactly, that's what I heard. Was that you know? So on the graphics side, the graphics team added a render thread, which sort of helps, so that it's always there's a thread that's always kind of busy serving, you know, the UI to make it smooth, right? And I don't know if there's similar things that we can do or have done with audio, right? To make sure that it gets to interrupt often enough that you don't have audio jank. Is there a term for audio jank?
A glitch.
Glitch. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So I don't know where we are with that.
You're asking questions.
If only we knew someone on the audio team, we could talk to you about the audio situation on Android.
The audio is a lot more difficult than video in a lot of ways. The video, you can actually duplicate a frame. If you're missing a frame, you can duplicate the previous frame and most people will never see it. And, you know, and that's at 60 frames a second or 30 frames a second. With audio, if you're maybe running at 48,000 audio frames a second, and if you drop like one frame, you'll hear this pop. People go, "Whoa, what was that?" You know, so it's much more catastrophic when the audio can't keep up. So it's really critical to have that. Also, video people tend to be, they're playing a movie that was filmed 20 years ago. If they play it now or half a second from now, it doesn't really matter. But the music stuff, generally, if you're performing, it's in response to a user action. So if you hit a drum pad, if you hit a note on a keyboard, you want to hear the sound right away. You don't want to like hit the key and then have the sound come out. So that's where the latency becomes really critical. If you're streaming music, like streaming MP3s or watching YouTube videos, then latency is not an issue. It doesn't matter when.
And those things are at odds with each other, right? If you want to have really, really short latency, then you can't really use large buffers. You're more likely to actually have a glitch if you have short buffers.
Right. So, I mean, the problem comes basically from when the operating system takes the processor away from the audio. So if it's like saying, oh, there's a network packet, and it's like, stop everything, and it's like chewing on this network packet, and the audio is like saying, wait, I've got to get this audio data out to the DAC. And if it can't, those buffers will run out, and you get a glitch. And so if you know that the system is going to have these network interrupts or these drivers are interfering with the system, then you have to make your buffers big enough so that if some network driver steals the processor for 10 milliseconds, you've got 20 milliseconds of data in your buffer that you can run down before you'll run out.
Right.
So
we solved this problem for graphics by having dedicated graphics cards so that the CPU didn't have to do very much, right? Just kind of like, hey, work on this now. Mm-hmm. Is there something like that for audio or no?
Well, the audio is generally just handled by the main CPUs. So if something interrupts those CPUs, then you can theoretically get a glitch. So traditionally people have used larger buffers to avoid the glitches, but then you have this latency problem.
Right.
Maybe we could play like on hold music if we run out of stuff in the buffer.
Well, sometimes
people will, they'll duplicate those, like the last buffer, like maybe they won't notice, you know, just pump the last
buffer. Well, it seems like when you listen to Hangouts or Skype or whatever, right, they have their own artifacts, which I think is doing this, right? It's trying to like fill the gap with something that seems like more talk. Yeah, exactly. So it's not actually dropping the frames, but it's doing something to guess what would be reasonable.
Yeah.
I don't know if we could do that sort of at a high level so that your game sound effect could sound not so glitchy.
And you'll really hear it on something like a flute solo. You have this nice, beautiful sine tone, and then you hear it pop in there, and it's really obvious. But if there's something like a snare drum playing, you probably wouldn't even hear the pop. But in certain music, it's
well, now you hear pop, and you just figure, oh, that must have come from like an LP. You know, there was dust on the record.
Oh, yeah, dust on the record. Right. Yeah.
The other artifact that I hear a lot, I think in video conferencing, you hear this a lot where like it'll skip a bunch because of, you know, network packet loss or whatever. And then you'll hear like a Cylon sound, right? The electronic sort of stretched sound. Would that indicate like you're getting down near the buffer and they just decide to play the rest of the bits really slowly because they're about to run out to avoid a glitch? I don't know. It's like they're not playing the samples at the same rate that they were actually input. Mm. Right? So I don't know.
Yeah. Is that done at the OS level, or would that be a chip kind of thing?
It sounds like higher up, like if they're playing compressed audio, where it's like playing, where it's doing some sort of spectral decompression. Because then what they can do is they can just kind of stretch the spectrum and just repeat the input, and can maybe sort of stretch and kind of cover the thing. But things are getting better. There's a pro audio effort underway in Android right now, and we've gotten the latency down significantly from where it was on previous platforms. So now it's, you know, very playable, and Glenn Kasten's been doing a great job on this, and he's working with manufacturers and the different OEMs, and they're very interested in tuning their drivers and looking at the system and looking at these sys traces and sort of, because basically anything in the system that takes the CPU can interfere with the audio. So it's not like just the audio guys have to like get their latency down. Is like the whole system has to be low latency and be performant and not take away the CPUs.
So that's the part where we basically send bits to the audio chip, right, so that it can make sounds. How is that related to MIDI? I assume that if you have MIDI as a client? Is that the right term? What? Where it where you want to play a MIDI song. That's something Android can do now, right? That's one of the new things. And how do we get from an actual like sets of note on, note off to, you know, the sound of a flute playing?
Yeah, that would be a software synthesizer.
Okay.
So, and there's been a software synthesizer in Android for a long time that lets you take a MIDI file, what they used to call polyphonic ringtone files. And you can take that file and sort of convert it from the note on, note off messages into an audio data stream. And that's done by a synthesizer that's just implemented in software.
Oh, so we have one of those built in?
So that's built in. But what it doesn't let you do is, or what you couldn't do easily before is to plug in a MIDI keyboard into Android and then play notes. Developers were doing that, but they had to write their own interface to the USB drivers. And so it was quite tricky to do that. And you also couldn't send MIDI messages between applications. So something that we've added in M is there's operating system support for MIDI keyboards or drum pads or anything you want to plug in to an Android device with this little OTG adapter. So you plug that in, you can play keyboards, the MIDI messages go into Android, and then from there you can do what you want. So a lot of people are writing software synthesizers that will take these MIDI messages and convert them to audio. You can also, you know, store them, play them back, write sequencers. But there's also, and then there's two more ways that MIDI is being used in Android. One is that you can pass MIDI messages between applications. So an app on Android can pretend that it's a synthesizer and it can have an input port. And you say, okay, here's my input port. Anybody can connect to it and then send it MIDI messages. So one app that's maybe really good at composing can create their composing app, and then two or three other people can write synthesizer apps, and then the composer app can just connect to whichever synthesizer they want to use. So it allows the apps to
this is like similar synergy to like the intent mechanism where you can say, okay, I want to connect to a drum machine, and you can sort of see, oh, I can choose between drum machine 1, 2 and synthesizer 3. Those would show up as sort of eligible inputs or outputs.
Yeah, so you can query for the eligible MIDI devices.
Is that a system service query or something?
There's a MIDI manager, and you can register for callbacks when devices are plugged in, and you can query for, you know, what's out there and what ports are available and what the name is, the manufacturer, all that kind of stuff.
Okay, so that was two mechanisms, right? So you can plug in the keyboard and play the notes in to play through one of the synthesizers that's on the device, and then the other is sending the MIDI information between devices, and then the other is we can play out too, right?
Yeah. Well, actually, the third, I'm glad you're counting that, keeping track is good. The third one is with Bluetooth. So with people sometimes get tangled up in wires, or you may want to leave your Android phone charging while you're playing the keyboard, but there's only one USB port. So there's a new standard, and this is brand new out of the MMA. They're just voting on it like now, and they're just getting it finalized. And the standard came from Apple and was adopted by the MMA. It's a nice standard. So now it's an industry standard, and we're supporting that. So you can have a Bluetooth keyboard, and you pair it with your Android app, and you can play wirelessly. The latency is a little bit higher just because Bluetooth has a pulse where it sends a packet every 15 milliseconds or, you know, roughly. So there's going to be a little bit of delay because of that. But it's fine for educational applications or sort of casual music apps.
Do you play?
I play mostly guitar, but some keyboard.
Okay. So because do you get to the point where you're playing and you know you have to be a little ahead? Like, do you kind of get the beat of, I press this and I just have to press a little earlier? Is that something that you kind of get used to, or is it so short that you don't even have to worry about it?
People do adjust, yeah. And like people who play pipe organ, sometimes there's a, you know, like a half second delay, or, you know, before the pipes sort of get going. So they're always sort of playing way ahead of the beat. It's a little disturbing if you're not used to it. If you're used to synthesizers that respond instantly, then you have to adjust. But people do adjust for that.
I think kids are probably much better at this system because kids, when they're first learning piano, really rush everything. So they do very well with this. So there's the Bluetooth thing. Did that come out in M as well? So we support that in M?
The MMA, right. Standardized that.
Right.
Yeah. In the M release, yes.
Yeah, all right. And is there also the ability to plug in a synthesizer that we then just play like through hardware instead?
Yeah, so you can plug in a MIDI keyboard into an Android, but you could also plug in a MIDI synthesizer.
Right.
So you can go the reverse direction and you can use Android to drive a MIDI synthesizer. So if you have some monster, you know, Moog synthesizer or something that you want to analog synthesizer gear that you want to control from your Android, you can do that. You can also use the Android as a keyboard. You can take the Android and then plug it into a laptop. And then use your Android as like a multi-touch tablet, or so you have multiple faders that you can all move all at once, which
and
is hard to do.
Control the software synthesizer.
Yeah,
on
so you're
laptop.
Controlling a synthesizer on the laptop.
Nice.
Which is nice because if you have a synthesizer on a laptop and you want to move multiple faders and you have a mouse, it's kind of hard to get to that. So you kind of want a MIDI controller that's got multiple knobs.
Right.
But with the multi-touch on the tablets, you can do that.
I can do my DJ mixing stuff on the...
Yeah.
Yeah. First, I'll have to learn how to do it. And that's just through standard like micro USB to USB to talk to the laptop? Or is there also some converter?
So it's like
there?
A normal debug cable.
Yeah.
And then you swipe down from the top and you can specify what you want the USB to be used for. So you can do it for charging or media transfer or MIDI. Just select the MIDI.
Is this that you were talking about an OTG adapter earlier? Is that what we're talking about now?
Is that
from serial port or MIDI port to USB?
The OTG is when you plug like a MIDI keyboard into the Android.
And what is that plug? Is that a USB? That's a normal USB plug that you plug into your Android device, right?
Yeah, you plug.
Okay.
So you'd have like a Type A regular USB.
Yeah.
That's on with the keyboard on the other end, and it adapts from that down to the micro USB that you can plug into the Android.
I see.
But when you want to go the other way, if you want to use the Android as a keyboard
and
control a laptop, then you would just hook it up like you would like a normal debug Android
debug
cable.
But what if
you want
to hook up to like a synthesizer? Don't they have these like round plugs?
The little 5-pin.
Yeah, the 5-pin DIN. Yes, the classic.
What's the name of that port?
That's a
MIDI?
5-pin DIN.
Okay.
Yeah, MIDI 5-pin DIN. You can buy devices that have those 5-pin DIN plugs on them. And then they have USB on the other end.
Okay.
And so almost anything you can buy today is going to have at least one USB MIDI plug. But if you want to connect to older synthesizers.
I think the people that have amps with vacuum tubes and play their music on turntables, they probably only use the 5-pin DINs.
Yeah.
Right. It sounds better through a 5-pin DIN than USB.
Way better.
I have a Roland synthesizer, and I think it's got those 5-pin DINs on it.
Yeah.
I have to dust it off now and try it.
I've got the ones, the instruments I bought recently have both, right? So in case you're playing to older stuff, like you've got the 5-pins, but they also have the USB option.
Yeah. I think a lot of manufacturers feel like it isn't MIDI unless it's got the 5-pin DIN, so they'll put them on there even if they don't get used.
The legacy port, it's not used, but it's just there for just so you have like cred MIDI. When you're on stage.
Classic. Vintage sound. Yeah.
So back to my really stupid question about MIDI. If I wanted to play music on my Android phone or tablet, where is that piano sound? I mean, you said there was a software synthesizer. Is there some sort of standard for what these
general
things
MIDI.
Sound like? Or is this just a really bad idea? And this is just for like recognizing a ditty in a game, but it's not really for hearing the music the way it was intended.
Yeah. Well, in the old days of MIDI, it was chaos. You would record a MIDI performance, you'd have a MIDI file, and you send it to somebody, and they'd go...
And it would play drums.
Wow. It's like those chords on the oboe were really surprising, you know, or that, you know, having those filter swoops on the drum, you know, and you just never know what you were going to get out because all the synthesizers had different programs, you know, different numbers. And which is fine for, you know, if you want those particular sounds. But I believe it was Roland came out with a sound canvas or something. And they said, here's a bunch of sounds like piano, violin, and glockenspiel, and helicopter, all the common instruments.
And glockenspiel, you know.
And they said, we'll put the piano on one. We'll put, you know, grand piano on one and a honky-tonk on two. And violin is 41 and the trombone is this. And then if you play your song back and you play it back on another synthesizer and they are also general MIDI, then you'll get the piano and the oboe. And they may sound, just this piano may sound better than that piano, or these trumpets may be a little more blaring or, you know, better or worse, but it'll be the trumpet.
So it didn't define what the samples were like, how they were created or how they sounded, but it defined what instrument it was representing.
Yeah.
Okay.
Which is close enough for most, you know, most things. I mean, like if you have a piece of music and it's played by different bands, they're all going to sound a little different, but you want the violin part to be played by the violin.
Right. So the sound bank, the synthesizer that we have on Android that we ship with, the ringtone thing that you referred to before, so that supports General MIDI. Does it also have its own banks, or it just supports the General MIDI stuff?
It supports General MIDI, but you can only play MIDI files through it.
Okay.
So there's no...
It does not implement this protocol we just talked about where it can respond to MIDI messages and play as if it were a live instrument.
No, it's not hooked up that way. But actually, I've seen developers who have taken that code from Android open source and
they're working on it.
Because you can create virtual MIDI devices in Android M, anybody could create a general MIDI synthesizer and then make it, you know, then users can download it and you've got a general MIDI synth from somebody that is manufacturers can.
So the vanilla release for M, though, like if you get the OTG converter or whatever, you plug in your keyboard into Android and play some notes, are they going to hear anything? Or we don't ship with the synthesizer that will actually...
Yeah, it doesn't ship with the synthesizer.
Okay.
And the reason is because there are just, you know, lots and lots of developers out there who are sort of aching to write MIDI applications for Android and provide these, and everybody wants to write their own synthesizers, and so there's no shortage of people who want to write the synthesizers. What they were lacking was the kind of infrastructure to communicate, send MIDI between applications, or get the MIDI in through the operating system in a kind of normal way, or support for these Bluetooth standards. And the developer can't do that. The developers can't go into the framework and add MIDI support in the framework, or create these this service that will send MIDI between applications. So we figure, okay, we'll do the parts that only we can do. And then building a synthesizer that's general MIDI that sounds good, with a dozen outside developers could do that. And so we're hoping they will. So we're just enabling, enabling the developers to then go out and write those synthesizers.
And do they exist already? Have you seen them?
People are writing these things.
I'm curious too what, developers that are listening to this podcast, what they'll come up with. It seems like you could do something that isn't really a synthesizer, just pretends to be, so you could have a really cool game, right? Which is driven by your keyboard, like your musical keyboard.
Either
you can like control Inbox or Gmail with your keyboard. It'd be kind of fun too for really rapid triaging of bugs.
Yeah. Hook it up to a drum pad. And
That's right.
Okay. All right. So yeah, I guess... What point would there be for us releasing something really basic when anybody that actually wants to use it as a real sound machine is going to either write their own or use a more professional one? So it seems like sound logic.
Yeah. I mean, it is a matter of priorities. I mean, we figure we better focus on getting the basic framework out and stable.
Seem like they take a lot of disk space, right?
Yeah,
I think like with GarageBand, the minute you want more than just like the built-in simple instruments, it's like, oh, we need another 50 gigabytes of your hard disk for these instruments.
Yeah.
Right? So if we were to try to put this on the system image, I mean, system image is always sort of, they try to keep it small, right? To make sure that Android works well on lower end devices as well. I don't think everyone would be cool with a built-in massive drum machine that had, 5,000 different tambourines.
Mm. The MIDI synthesizer libraries can be pretty small. I used to sell MIDI synthesizers for ringtone engines.
But those are like the computational synthesizers, right? The ones that are sort of like modulating a sine wave and like those, synthesizer.
The original one, they said, we really don't have any memory, so we want this to be as small as possible. So I had 128 melodic instruments and then, 40-something percussion instruments. And the whole library fit in 14 kilobytes.
Wow.
So, and then they said, you know what? That piano, that, it's like, it doesn't really sound like a Bösendorfer. It's like, well, I got two oscillators on there. And obviously it's like, what do you want? It would do FM or it would do, some things sound better if you're synthesizing. Like if you're doing, a sawtooth synth sound.
Yeah.
If you sample one and you loop it, then you're going to kind of hear the loops, or you're going to, and if you do it in synthesis, you can make a better one. But piano or violin or, it helps to cheat.
Classic guitar, that one is tricky.
Yeah, acoustic guitar. Yeah. So it helps to cheat, and if you can use samples. So then the next round they said, well, let's add some samples. And then it bumped it up to like 100, 200 kilobytes, but that's still not much. You can even go
that's like less than a launcher icon.
I know.
On the Nexus 6, like with the, yeah.
And then if you go up to like a megabyte, it can sound like pretty good. But of course, some people then you download 5 DVDs with, 30 gigabytes of sound samples, and you can go crazy with it, but you can get a very good sounding MIDI synthesizer in, a few megabytes.
So of the three different mechanisms that we exposed in Marshmallow, can you give a sense of what the API surface is like? Like, how do people actually develop for this thing? Either they're, consuming the input and creating sounds out of it, or they're generating the sounds being sent over, creating the files or whatever.
Mm-hmm. It's pretty easy. You there's a MIDI manager, and so you get that as a system service. And then once you have the manager, you can query for a list of devices. So you basically what's already out there, and you get back an array of device info. And each one, the device info tells you what the manufacturer is, how many input ports, how many output ports, bunch of information like that. So then you can present that to the user, and then let the user decide where they want to send their keyboard information, or what keyboard they want, what source they want to connect to. And then you can open the device, and that's asynchronous. So you sort of request, open that device, and you give it a callback. And then when it finishes, your callback is past the device, and then you've got an open device, and then you can open a port, and that happens immediately. And then you can just send and receive MIDI bytes from these ports.
Okay. So this is whether you're sending stuff out or whether you're receiving stuff in, it's the same way of connecting.
Basically, yeah. So it's all the same up to the point where you either open an input port or you open an output port.
Okay.
Now, some people, they look at the API and they go, well, is this backwards? I want to send data, so shouldn't I be opening an output port? But the way the API is set up, it's set up so that it makes sense from the context of a device. So if you're creating a device, let's say you create a synthesizer, you give that synthesizer an input port, right? So just like if you buy a synthesizer, it's got an input port on the back of the synthesizer. So in software, you would if you create a synthesizer, it has an input port. If you create a keyboard thing, it's got an output port. So if you look at the ports that are out there, you would open an input port on the synthesizer, and then you send it data. So you're not sending it through an output port, you're sending it straight into the input port on the synthesizer.
Okay.
If you have a device, you might send it out of your output port to the input of a synthesizer, but you can also just bypass that.
Okay.
And just open a synthesizer's input directly and just send it notes. So it's very simple. And you can timestamp them. So if it's helpful in an app to just maybe, if you're like doing a score, composing app, you could wake up every half a second and just compose the next measure, and you just fire off all the notes to the synthesizers with the timestamps, and you go back to sleep, and you wake up at the next measure, fire off all the notes, so you don't have to sit there and wake up and on every note, because when you do that, there's a danger you might wake up a little bit late.
But does the thing on the other side understand what to do with the timestamps? Is that part of the protocol?
The timestamps are nanoseconds, and the same timestamps as come out of the audio system, so they're synchronized in that way. And then there's a utility that's an event scheduler. So you can give it a MIDI event with a timestamp. You push them in there, and then later you can come back and say, okay, it's this time, what events are ready, and then you can pull out the events. So that's in a there's some code samples, like the MIDI synth example and the MIDI scope. MIDI synth example has these. So in that MIDI synth example is this MIDI event scheduler. And it's a little tricky to do that, but if you just grab this object out of that code sample, it makes it very easy to use the timestamps.
Okay.
So I'm not going to ask another stupid question, but I always wondered how this works, how you synchronize audio and video.
Mm-hmm.
That might be slightly off topic. We're not allowed to ask off-topic questions. Can we ask an off-topic question?
You're talking about that, there's event scheduling with nanosec. Because I'm thinking if you're trying to have some sort of visual event,
mm-hmm.
right, and you have this soundtrack that's playing, it's really important that, so for example, for the Play Movies app, right? The, you know, when you see the face talking, the, actually the audio is matching it.
Yeah.
And
unless
you,
it's a foreign film.
Yes.
Foreign is important. They move their lips funny.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm just wondering if you want to do something with MIDI instead, if you wanted to really synchronize, you know that you're going to play this playback and you really want music events to happen at the same time.
Yeah.
Is there some way to do that? Or is it really sort of, you just, as long as you synchronize the start, things should, the clocks should be timed and things should work.
Right. It's actually, it's better if you know ahead of, a little bit ahead of time. Well, if you're playing a keyboard, then when you hit a key, you just play it as quick as you can. So but then if you're playing back a performance and you have these timestamps and you want it to come back accurately when you play it with using the timestamps, then what you do is you pre-calculate and you know as you're generating your audio, you know sort of what frame you're on for that audio. And in the audio track, you can call get audio timestamp and it'll tell you that a particular frame is going to happen at a particular time. And it gets this from the HAL. So the HAL at a low level kind of knows what this timing is of the output because it's close to the hardware.
So it's a bit like two musicians where one listens to the other and corrects itself. So if for some reason the video is playing back slower or faster than you thought, you're basically waiting for some sort of heartbeat during the performance to go, okay, now I need to synchronize. We're actually really here now.
Yeah. So in the video, in the case of a movie, the video and the audio are both timestamped. And the video, you can sort of like drop frames or adjust and the user's not going to be disturbed by that particularly. But the audio, you can't play with that much.
I see. So it's typically the video you would adjust for where the audio is.
The video tracks the audio. So you sort of start the audio and you get back these timestamps and you know, okay, this audio is going to be playing at this particular time. And then you sort of queue up your video buffers and you schedule them so they come out right time. And they each have their own pipelines, but you can schedule them so they come out.
Cool. Interesting.
What I heard was that's tricky.
Yeah, I'm sure that is tricky.
Okay. I was going to bring it back and ask, okay, so we've got the API, you connect up you create the ports, you've got data coming in. How? Is this like a byte buffer? I mean, are you receiving basically raw MIDI protocol?
Yeah, there's a MIDI receiver, which is basically given a byte buffer and an offset and a count and a timestamp. So you know you've got 3 bytes in this array. And then you can, when the bytes come in, they may be sort of coming in some serial port or coming in at some arbitrary rate and coming in bursts. They're not necessarily aligned to frames. So in the same library I mentioned before, there's a MIDI event scheduler. There's also a MIDI framer. And you can just take this kind of unaligned MIDI data, push it through the framer, and then the MIDI framer will spit out complete messages. So you don't have to deal with like half a message like, oh, I got the note on, but I don't know what the pitch is or the loudness. So you'll get complete messages, and then the first byte tells you whether it's a note on or a control change or a pitch bend, and then you know the data bytes follow that.
And then framer is also, that has a byte buffer? Or is it sending it in individual messages then?
It will buffer, like if you send it like 1 byte at a time, it'll just sort of buffer up until it gets a complete message. But the complete MIDI messages are all one, two, or three bytes long. So
I imagine creating an iterator and then asking for next. Right, we'll just do like a for each loop on.
Well,
is
it callback? I mean, do you basically register yourself with the framer and it tells you here's a message whenever it's right.
So this MIDI receiver is an abstract class that can receive MIDI messages. So the MIDI framer is a MIDI receiver, and then you can create your own MIDI receiver, which actually will respond to those complete messages. So what you do is you connect your receiver to the MIDI framer, and then you connect your MIDI framer to a MIDI port that's going to be sending you the data. So you can chain these together. So if you want a MIDI port, if you want to filter out the pitch bend for some reason, or filter out active sensing or different messages, you can sort of daisy chain these MIDI receivers.
This just really should be a game. You know the SingStar game a few years ago? People would like sing along with something keyboard, play along. I can see the game now. Either that or like Candy Crush with a keyboard. I really want to use my old keyboard.
I just want to play. Is it okay to play music with keyboards? Is that old school? I don't know.
I've seen people do that. But you can also do like very strange things with me. I used to work on an experimental music language many years ago, and people were using MIDI for like they had one system where they had TV cameras aimed at a tank containing a goldfish, and as the goldfish would swim around, it would trigger certain zones, and that would send MIDI messages to a vocal processor, and then a poet who was speaking this kind of weird Australian poetry, it would change his voice based on where the fish was moving in the tank.
I imagine this as an exhibit at like SIGGRAPH or something in one of those sort of offbeat areas.
The back room that like only 1% of the people ever stumble upon.
It seems like it might be a really reasonable way to do, you know, inputs from an external thing.
Yeah.
Right? I mean...
Yeah, because you can go out and buy a box with a bunch of knobs on it for $50.
It's a MIDI controller,
and then you plug it in, and you can use those knobs to control anything. It can be, you know, it could be game input, or
So both for controlling smoke machines, which could be very practical in many cases, or for inputs.
It's just a protocol. It's basically like a precursor to JSON, I think.
But what I'm hearing is that there's really good support in the OS, right? So you can very easily write an app that just responds to these stimuli from this external thing, and that would be kind of cool.
Okay, so experimental MIDI language, what more about that then? What was it trying to accomplish, or what did it accomplish?
Yeah, well, this was way back. You can't see my gray hair in the on the radio, but...
Let the record note that there are a couple.
Okay. But in the sort of mid-80s, a lot of people were trying to do experimental music and hook up, basically trying to control synthesizers with their computers and doing just like horrendous hacks to get this to happen. People would go into the Casio keyboards and they'd solder wires onto the keyboard scanning circuitry, and then they would simulate key presses on the Casio keyboards to try and, you know, have the computer like play notes, you know, on the sensor. So when MIDI came along, suddenly all you had to do was hook up a serial port, and it really opened things up. But then people had to write interrupt handlers in assembly language to like get the MIDI bytes and stuff. So these, you know, these poor musicians are trying to hack, you know, interrupt handlers in assembly on the Mac. And so I said, okay, well, let's take the basic tools that musicians are going to want to do and put them in a language. This is called HMSL. And but we don't want to impose a style on that, you know, any particular style. This one, you know, like disco is coming out. We didn't want to like impose any sort of, you know, notions of what, you know, things are supposed to sound like. We wanted people to be creative. So the only musical thing that was sort of a requirement is that you had to deal with time. So the piece had to take place in time. But there was not necessarily anything to do with pitch or instruments or anything else, but you could do that. So you could create these abstract shapes, and you could manipulate them, and you could play them, and you could organize them into this hierarchy. So it's called the hierarchical music specification language. And to use it, you pretty much had to be a programmer. So there weren't that many people doing it, but the people who were using it were people who would spend months. They would create, you know, these amazing, you know, pieces with, you know, genetic algorithms or and people were hooking up DSPs, which was the only way to get real-time music synthesis at the time, was to, you know, wire up a DSP with an interface board and wire wrapping and soldering, and you'd wire a DSP up to an Amiga, and you could get real-time synthesis. And then people would do network pieces where they're, we did one that was a nuclear reactor simulator where you would...
Simulator, not a real one.
Not a real one.
Just
no,
to be clear. Okay.
In the college, the college would not allow a real one. So when you'd fire, you would send a note, and we call it a notron, you know, instead of a neutron. So when the notron would reach the other computer, it could either be absorbed or it would like cause a chain reaction and fire one, two, or three more neutrons. So and you would control the piece by raising or lowering these virtual control rods in the reactor. So... actually, the thing was very unstable. As soon as you'd start to like raise the rods, it would suddenly reach this chain reaction and just explode every time. You know, this massive exponential burst of notes. And a friend of mine worked on a nuclear reactor on a submarine, and so I said, like, how, you know, they don't always blow up. I mean, you know, real reactors. How is this? And he said, well, when they start to like get going and they heat up, they expand, and then when it expands, there's less there's more room for the neutrons to escape, and that kind of stabilizes the reaction. So I modeled that in the simulator for the music, and so as the piece would pick up, it would kind of like expand and adjust for that in the kind of physics model, and then suddenly it just became totally playable. You could just like raise or lower the rods and do all this stuff. So these are kind of weird MIDI things that, you know, people were doing. There's actually an exhibit going on in London. I just opened in at the Whitechapel Gallery. So they're showing these old MIDI pieces and concert notes and dusty old, you know, circuit boards and, you know, things like that.
Are people still using HMSL?
It sort of went, well, a lot of the people that, some of the people that were using it were people like James McCartney, who then wrote Super Collider, and David Zagrali, who then wrote Max MSP. And those languages, Max MSP in particular, still going strong. But we just,
if you try to play it on your 5X, and probably just going to play it all on grand piano, and it's going to sound pretty funny.
The language itself was like all 68,000 assembly language. So the core,
we have devices based on
whenever
that architecture.
Whenever anyone says Amiga or 68,000 assembly, we just have to like just a little applause inserted.
So it was like, so we had the assembly core, and then it was all fourth based above that, and then this kind of music stuff on top of the fourth. So we have a new fourth that's written in C. And then we're just porting HMSL to that. So now it'll run on I was playing it on my laptop the other day. That's where MIDI kind of came from a very experimental sort of hacker,
right?
You know, community of people doing wacky things with goldfish.
So
the goldfish died, by the way, at one point during the performance.
I've always heard that. That there, you know, there's this connection, this brain connection between people that are music people and people that are math people. It's like there's some overlap there in the way that people think or the things that they enjoy, the patterns that their brain goes through. And maybe it was just because all the musicians were forced to think about this stuff in the 80s to make it work.
So I think you're right. I've definitely seen that pattern.
So you're on the media team right now, and then prior to that, you were doing stuff in Android TV, also in audio, I assume?
Yeah, working mostly with sort of audio streaming, adding support for AC3 over HDMI cable. So when you plug your Nexus player into the TV, you can ship multi-channel surround sound over HDMI.
Right.
And then before that, I was working mostly in game industry and music industry.
Okay. Yeah, you mentioned 3DO earlier.
Game consoles.
Classic. Classic. Yeah. Well, the classic story in like game technology in the Valley in general, sort of one of those high flyers and really low fallers.
Is MIDI a good way to do games? Like if you want a soundtrack to your game, is MIDI something reasonable to choose for Android now?
Yes, and people could, you know, select different output synthesizers or send their MIDI to different synthesizers.
So the only limitation is that you would do it in Java. So if your game is not in Java, you put a Java agent in there, and that's how you drive your MIDI.
Yeah, and in general, the latency issues are not so critical as they are in audio. With MIDI, you can keep your buffers as low as possible because you only need the buffers in case there's a burst of data. So the buffers generally run low, and the latency is not so much a problem when you're sending MIDI between apps. It's different than if you're sending audio.
You would kick off a MIDI event to play the song, and then you would just play sound effects on top of that. Is that how you would do it?
I mean, the difference between and you could use MIDI. You wouldn't necessarily have to use Android MIDI, but people use MIDI just within their games sometimes. Okay. And the reason they do that is because they can make the music be changing all the time. If you want to play, you know, your favorite band and actually hear, you know, the sort of real people singing those songs, then you want to be streaming audio. But if you want the music to, you know, be responding really directly to the gameplay, then it's helpful to use something like MIDI because you can just like change keys or something. If you get wounded, you could like switch to a minor key or something, or you could, you know, actually, change the tempo or things like that. So that the nature of the music and the character of the music is changing based on the gameplay.
Are there known good algorithms for doing that, for morphing from one melody into another in a way that sounds good? So if you have, let's say, the happy main character song, and then you have the main character in trouble song,
mm-hmm.
I don't want like a jump cut from one song to the other. But I would like it, like things are happening and maybe you want to start putting in sort of, you know, like, is there some way to do that that's sort of known in music theory?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the mapping between the sort of emotional states and the music has been a hot research topic. And there's some sort of real obvious things like, you know, changing to minor keys.
Oh, yeah. No, so sort of I understand that. Down, like, but, I actually have
two
different...
But you can morph between, yeah, there's a fellow down at UC Santa Cruz, Larry Polansky, who's developed these metrics where you can analyze different musical fragments and have a metric that determines, sort of measure them against each other, and then interpolate, basically, different melodies or interpolate different musical material.
So that would be a really cool library as well, I think, if you can sort of, you know, in the game engine, sort of, okay, I have this thing and I want you to morph over into that seamlessly.
Mm-hmm.
And if it could do that, and it sounded as if the composer had done it, that would be kind of sweet.
Yeah, yeah. Particularly if it's some like a looping kind of thing where you just sort of gradually, and people have their tolerance for repetitive looping has gone up over the years. So you could, you know, like just have some loop over 10 minutes where like just adding a few notes here and there.
I can tell you my tolerance for the Candy Crush song when I'm sitting on the BART train is very, very low at this point. Use headphones, people.
Yeah. Wonder if you could also use it for different gameplay things, like if they're getting close to some border condition, like the, you know, the edge of the world, and you want to guide them away from it, then you just introduce some like Bartok or maybe Hindemith, you know, some really cacophonous stuff that's just disturbing, and so they just kind of back away from that into the sweet melodies again.
Yeah. Well, you could probably even do with that the pitch wheel, you know. The pitch wheel in MIDI that should never, ever be used, people. You know, that one. You start just making the music sound a little off, you know.
The reason I got rid of my most recent instrument was the pitch wheel basically had a hardware glitch. Like the spring broke on it, and I would be playing piano, which should never be pitch wheeled, and it would just pop down to the wrong key, or not even necessarily a key, just a quarter tone somewhere, right in the middle of a song. Very disturbing. Yeah, pitch wheels. Just no. Let's see. It seems like we covered a lot about MIDI and Android MIDI. Did we?
It's just like a super interesting topic. We haven't talked that much about Android really. But I think the developer story we did cover, right? It's really MIDI receiver and the
MIDI manager,
MIDI framer.
There's a good example to check out for a lot of the stuff. I think that's all straightforward. Yeah, I think the really deep and interesting stuff is more the background of MIDI, the technology itself. So it's kind of cool that it's there and people can use it now. Were people already doing this through the more painful manual mechanism you talked about before, where it's like they got to write the USB driver to get the data in, do something with it?
The Android developers, yeah. Several people had written, you know, directly to the USB device.
Yeah,
which works and it's fine. But now they can take advantage of, you know, communicating between different apps or have it be supported on the system. So
I wonder if they're going to change their apps to like just get rid of that old code because they don't need it. I mean, I guess it only works on Marshmallow and Forward.
Yeah.
So they can't ditch that.
So for legacy, there's still reasons to do that. So we see this as, you know, a multi-year progression toward per audio. So we're getting the MIDI stuff out there, getting the latency down on as many platforms as possible. And performance always keeps going up, which helps when you're doing a lot of software synthesis. So, but we're hoping that to make the Android platform be really, you know, a strong platform for music development and experimental music, because these mobile devices are different than normal musical instruments, and the nature of the touch screen and the connections with the mobile networks and the kind of social interactions of it allows people to create music in ways that's, you know, really different than what's been in the past. I remember when I was a kid way back when, and I thought I compared the music of, you know, like the 60s and 70s to the music of the 30s and 40s, which was sort of big band, and then suddenly it was Jimi Hendrix and distorted guitars and keyboards, and so there are these bands with guitar and a rhythm guitar and a keyboard and a drum, and I thought, man, imagine what it's going to be in the 90s or, you know, in the next century. It's like, it's
keyboard,
just going to be totally
guitar,
different.
Drum.
The bands are like guitar, keyboard, drums. And, you know, so I'm hoping that to see more, you know, music making where people are going beyond the sort of very old traditional modes of music making.
Yeah, it seems like the technology is mostly being used for taking the type of bands, the type of music that we're creating with traditional bands and simply doing it inside a computer instead.
Yeah, so you have all this amazing signal processing you just use to recreate a 60s, you know, Marshall amp or something.
I love the...
Make the sound dirtier again now. It was too clean.
Right. The apps that are like realistically mimicking the old synthesizer interface, you know, with the patch cables and all this stuff. I'm like, I thought we'd gotten beyond that. Do we really need to? I guess it's the same people that are, you know, playing their music off of vinyl so that they can hear the, you know, the vintage pops. But I don't know. It's never interested me to like take it back to that level, you know, to actually like manually create the tape loop. And
well, what is it, the Pono player? What is that thing that is supposed to be like even higher fidelity? That's like the highest fidelity audio you can get now. And it's Neil Young is behind it, right? And I'm thinking his music?
He did a recording.
It's not supposed to be that high fidelity, right? It's not
it's
exactly
kind of grunge,
like, it's not like crystal clear audio, you know, pin drop sound. No, it's got more the...
He did a recording, was it 10, maybe 15 years ago, where he released a song that was supposed to mimic the old crappy sound of vinyl. Like it had, he introduced artifacts into it that sounded like scratchy vinyl because like he thought it was a shame that we had all this digital technology. It was really taking away from the experience of what I think is a horrible music playing experience of dealing with the turntable and all the limitations that it had. So I'm sure he's behind something like this because he really likes that stuff. I don't know.
Yeah, I really like Neil Young, but I'm a bit skeptical about the very, very high sample rate. You know, the people pushing up to 192 or, you know, 384, these very, very high sample rates and, you know, 32-bit audio. There's a point, it's sort of like the Retina displays in the resolution for the laptops. The pixels kept getting smaller and smaller and they're crisper and crisper and better until it got so small that the human eye cannot resolve pixels.
Right.
At which point they said, we're done.
Yeah.
We got it. And audio technology has been getting better and better. And there used to be like these 8-bit DACs that, you know, you'd run them at 8 kilohertz and, you know, the telephony systems. And then it was like CDs came out and, you know, it was 44-100 and 16-bit. And arguably 24-bit is a little better than that. And, you know, maybe you go up to 92 kilohertz just so you got a little room. But at that point, I think you're done. I mean, the human ear, you know,
can't hear it.
Yeah, you know, 15 to 20,000 hertz max. And if you go too high up, then you start creating, you start having these higher frequencies, if they're actually there. There's a lot of high-end audio recordings that are recorded, you know, they at 192 or 300, you know. But you look at the spectrum, and there's no energy beyond like 20,000 hertz. So there's actually nothing there. But if there is, it's actually a problem because then you have to get rid of it when you try and play it on real hardware, and you get these kind of weird distortions, intermodulation distortion, and things that can happen, which is actually a problem. So I'm a sample rate skeptic, I guess, with these high sample rates.
I'm happy to hear that because I do think of the audiophiles in the world as just taking things too far. Like, I'm really picky about my music. I'm more of a music snob. Like, I'm picky about what I listen to and the quality of the music that's being played, but I'm definitely not a high-end audio thing. But, yeah, it seems like people take it to a level where it's not physically making a difference. I've been happy with CDs, frankly, since the late 80s.
Yeah.
Like the quality of the sample rate is just fine, at least for the music that I'm listening to there. It's fine by me. So I'm not quite sure how other people's ears work.
Yeah, there's a point of diminishing returns.
Yeah. All right. Should we end on that policy note then?
Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
Be happy with what you've got, people.
That's right.
Well, thank you so much for your work on Android Audio and for talking to us.
Well, thanks so much for having me. It's been fun.